today's episode.
What I wanted to do with La Borinqueña was to create a brand that really resonated to the people. Something that really didn't have a corporate foundation
agenda
to it.
Or
something, nothing that was kind of like contrived.
It's not about selling the most dolls. It's about reality.
And then that image became something more than I expected it. And to hear and read women online responding so positively, and even men who come up to me after reading the book and they'll say, I see myself in her. This is amazing. I finally see a story that looks like my family, that sounds like me. And the joke is always when many of these women, they actually think that she actually is somebody real.
This is Bill Alzaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by InstaSleep Mint Melts, the drug-free, convenient sleep aid that melts in your mouth. They were invented by the physician called Dr. Lee during his medical residency, where he saw the need for an effective sleep aid that didn't contain harmful chemicals, cause addiction, or leave him feeling groggy in the morning. I've used them myself for long flights and for sorting out my sleeping pattern after a trip. They taste like mints and are really convenient since they melt in your mouth. InstaSleep Mint Melts are now available at Target, Amazon, or directly on their site at instasleep.co. Hello, Edgardo. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thank you for having me, bro.
So we actually met, we're here in New York right now. We met in 2015. In the time that we've met and today, there's been so much that's been going on. And I've been following from afar on Facebook between the cute pictures of your kids and all your impressive videos and posts you've been putting up in the last year and a half. There's so much for us to talk about today, but the kind of theme of today's conversation is activism through art. And you're a true creator, as you know, what I've called within my podcast, which is someone who's building things and making things across different disciplines. And you've been doing that for many years. So we'll go into all your background in a minute. Actually, I'll let you introduce yourself before I start doing it for you.
Sure.
Who are you, man? What are you working on?
My name is Edgardo Miranda Rodriguez. I'm a New Yorker, live in Brooklyn with my wife and my two sons. I run my own design studio, Somos Arte, for the last 17 years. I recently got into publishing with comic books, starting a publishing company with legendary hip-hop icon DMC from Run DMC. Our company is Daryl Makes Comics. And I had my debut as a writer with Marvel last year. And at the same time, soon after that book came out, I decided to put out my own creator-owned project under my own studio, La Borinqueña. And that's been an amazing ride. And
what does that mean for people?
Sure. La Borinqueña comes from the original language spoken by the Taínos, the inhabitants of Puerto Rico, the island in the Caribbean. La Borinqueña literally comes from the word Borinquen, which is the name of the island. Originally, it was called Borinquen, not Puerto Rico. So La Borinqueña translates into the Puerto Rican woman. It's also the name of the island's national anthem.
All right. Cool, man. Well, we're going to go deep diving into that later, but you've got a really, really cool, interesting background. I don't even know to start. But before we do that, it would be cool for us to kind of take a step back from what you're doing right now. I found some really cool, fun pictures, which obviously people listening to this can't see it, but this will be posted on creatorlab.fm if people want to see the four pictures I just shared with
Gata
said. So could you walk me through a few of these and describe what they are to
people?
Well,
the first one is me holding my poodle mutt, Scruffy. We actually used to live in the South Bronx. As growing up, I would collect bottles and cans to collect the nickels that I could accumulate to buy my comic books. In the picture, I'm actually holding a comic book, The New Mutants, which was actually an offshoot of the X-Men. So I was always into comic books as a child. Yeah. And I'm sitting on top of like linoleum. And instead of being a B-boy striking a pose, I'm actually like in a B-boy stance holding a stack of comic books. Next to that is an image of me as a spoken word artist. In the early 90s, right after college, I went to Colgate University. I took a try at spoken word. And it was an opportunity for me to kind of like write poetry and perform it in such a way that would provide me the forum to share my story, my narrative, my biography, my experience with anyone who was within earshot of me. And I was very fortunate enough to grow up in that scene with a lot of very acclaimed poets. Many of them actually went on to become deaf poets, and they went on to Broadway and were quite possibly the first poets to win Tony Awards. And many of those artists are still friends of mine to this day.
That's at Neorican, right?
That's at the Neorican Poets Cafe.
Low East Side, however you define it.
And I actually had a piece I used to perform back in the days called Adobo Soup. Mm. And it comes from the fact that we were so poor, we actually at one point just had seasoning salt and hot water, and we would actually just eat that. But that, for me, was kind of like symbolic of my youth. So it was something specific to me, but an opportunity to kind of like share my narrative. So I've always been open about sharing my life, because I've always been aware of where I started, and I always knew that I could always just go up from there. There was no way to go lower than from where I started.
Yeah.
And the next image is actually me with my droopy afro in the early 90s also, holding a t-shirt. It says Muévete, which is Spanish for move, but it's more of a call to action for young activists to kind of like move, get involved. And that was actually a logo that I designed for a youth conference that actually started back in 1993 in New York City. And every year, a group of activists such as myself would gather and organize these events for free. And we provide workshops on everything from political identity, voter registration, heritage, even sexual education. And it was a free day. Children could come, hear live music, poetry, get workshops. And that was actually like one of the first graphics that I ever designed, like straight out of college. And then the last image is actually as recent as last November, when Mayor Bill de Blasio actually offered me a proclamation, awarding me and recognizing me for my work as an activist and as an artist in New York City, especially raising awareness for my culture as a Puerto Rican, more specifically for my recent project, La Borinqueña. And that was an amazing honor and an amazing experience that I was able to share with my wife and my two sons, and to be able to actually speak from City Hall, from his podium,
yeah,
with the New York State City seal on it, was rather surreal. But it just felt like a really good point in my narrative as a young activist outside of City Hall protesting. Mm. And here I was, you know, goodness, more than 20 years later inside City Hall, not necessarily protesting, but keeping the message consistent that there's a necessity to respect one another's culture, celebrate each other's culture, and we should have the forum to do that. And no one should feel that they should hide from doing that, nor no one should feel that they should prohibit anyone from doing that.
Yeah.
I think one of the most amazing things about the internet is the voices that are now being heard, voices that never had a forum, and they're very articulate right now. It's really phenomenal when you look at the fact that we purchase and consume so much content that doesn't actually reflect us. And we're expected to continue to purchase that content even though it doesn't reflect us. And when we try to present or propose content to mainstream publishers or studios, oftentimes when these projects don't see the light, they're received with comments like, it just doesn't seem like it's going to be received well by people. I just don't get it. It's a little too hard to digest. It's a little too heavy-handed. But yeah, we're expected to digest Friends, and we're expected to digest, you know, all this content and media that is not always representative of us.
Yeah.
I mean, we always have this joke at home. It's like, wow, white people are so funny because this is all we see on television. Yeah. And it's a joke because if you watch, you know, television and you're a person of color and you're never interacting with anyone who's not a person of color, you would think, oh, white people are just hilarious. They walk around with like laugh tracks behind them all the time. And it's, you know, it's just not the case, you know. And so the work that I'm doing just feels that much more relevant right now. And I think that the power of the arts is there to inspire and to reflect what's going on in society. And that's what I'm trying to do with my work now. Now, many people oftentimes don't realize and recognize that myself as a Puerto Rican, I was born here in the United States. But even if I was born in Puerto Rico, I would still be an American. We're not naturalized citizens, but we're granted our American citizenship merely by birth. But when we come to the United States, and we don't immigrate. We're not immigrants. We migrate. Yeah. Just like if you're moving from California to New York, you know?
Yeah.
But when we come to New York City or any other parts of the continental United States, we're not received as American citizens. We're received as second-class citizens. And that reality is the same reality that so many immigrants feel, specifically immigrants of color feel when they come to this nation. So we have a lot more in common with our sisters and brothers who are immigrating to this country than we have with the very Americans that are born and raised in this country. And I recognize that, and I am aware of that, and I reflect that in my storytelling. And I'm also quick to call out the hypocrisy within our own communities.
In what way?
For example, in Latin American media, it's notoriously underrepresenting the diversity of Latinos. So you'll more than likely see Latinos of European descent on screen as leads on the telenovelas or reporting the news. When you actually see the stories that they're covering, you're actually seeing the brown and the dark brown faces that actually do represent the rest of Latin America, you know. And I find that absurd when our own media perpetuates this internalized, or not even internalized, a very blatant form of prejudice. And it's really saying that we are a race of a European descent. And actually, the reality about being a Latino, oftentimes it's misinterpreted. I'm not a race. I'm an ethnicity.
Yeah.
I am a composite of races. I exist representing European, but I also represent African, Asian, Native American, because that is a reflection of the heritage of being a Latino. From Puerto Rico to Mexico to Chile to Argentina, we're a product of the world's imperialism and colonization, you know, and to actually have media that doesn't represent and recognize that, it's an irresponsibility. So given a chance to produce content for the first time, when I created my comic book series, La Buringueña, I took a very strong position to have her represented as a darker complexion woman of color, to show the diversity that exists in our own families, not even so much in our own community, but in our own families. Like I am very clearly a lighter complexioned, you know, Latino, a lighter complexioned Puerto Rican. But the reality is that no one knows what the rest of my family looks like, because I don't walk around with one of those accordion style wallets with photos inside of it, you know. And as a result, you don't recognize the diversity that exists within my own family and the diversity that exists within many of our own families.
Yeah.
And I feel as people of color who create content, we have a stronger sense of responsibility to continue creating this content and to raise the bar. And what I do in my part is I infuse ideas and I infuse my perception and observations of the world into my work. I don't tell stories very heavy-handedly, because I like to tell stories through a form of evolution. The character's growth is the best way to share with a larger audience real issues. And I think that's what's important, that we have to recognize the familiarity that we have as the human race and the familiarity that we have as people of color. And with that universality that we share, those values that we share, we actually will recognize the power that we actually have. And that power is what keeps us grounded. And that power is what also gives us the resilience to be resistant. And I think that's what we need. We need consistent resistance, and we need consistent content, and we need consistent information that provides an alternative to the facts that were being presented.
Hashtag alternative facts. Right?
So it is.
That's super interesting. We were going to go into some more thoughts on that a little bit later, but one thing stood out to me. It sounded like from a very young age you had this activist mentality, or you were at least self-aware enough to see what's going on around you.
Well, I grew up poor.
Yeah,
I grew up with a single mother, raised on public assistance in the South Bronx, living amongst vacant lots, abandoned tenements. And at a very young age, I was very well aware of the injustice, the inconsistency that existed being a citizen of this country. And here we were given all of these opportunities and access. But it's just like Senator Sanders says, just because we have access to a mansion doesn't mean we have the means to purchase that,
yeah.
You know? And I realized at a very young age that it was the only thing that was going to keep me from those opportunities was going to be a lack of education. So I turned very much
to education.
Where did
that come from, though? I
had this kind of like epiphany as a child. I came from, my mother is a very heartfelt woman who is really rooted in her values in church, very conservative, but very much politically liberal, interestingly enough, and very much a woman who is just centers her reality around her immediate family. She doesn't really understand nor concern herself with what happens outside of that. And as a result, the standards that she set were very low.
Yeah.
As long as I was happy and healthy, she was fine with that. We didn't live in a very strict household that pushed us to reach certain goals. Her main concern was me maintaining a neat room. You know, that was her main concern. So at a very young age, I don't know what was that moment of enlightenment for me, but my older cousin, who's kind of like a mother figure to me, mm-hmm. has always told me that I was precocious. And we're talking like younger than 10. I just had this kind of like self-awareness that I needed to see something better. When I was a student in high school, I learned about apartheid, and I was learning about what was happening in South Africa, and I learned about what Nelson Mandela stood for and stood against. And that fascinated me, because here was a man whose resilience was so strong and so consistently, like his principles were so consistently on point, that he survived his prison term of 27 years. And I remember when he was released, when I was a freshman at Colgate. And that fascinated me so much. And I was so fascinated by young people, even though they were a few years older than me, who took it upon themselves to lead national, if not international, boycotts.
Yeah.
So at a young age, I saw the power of the voice. I saw the power
and
of
activism and
yeah.
what it could actually achieve.
And then I just kind of like brought it home. And it was in college that I learned through a mutual activist, I guess, a friend of mine, who was actually working in New York City now, in government. And he, when we were both young people as students, he introduced me to a lot of activism that was happening in my own community, in my own neighborhoods in New York
yeah.
City. And I was completely unaware of such political activist groups like the Young Lords Party. And when I learned about the Young Lords, it occurred to me that they were only 20 years before my time in college. And I was like, wait a minute, this is all happening like in the early 1970s. These guys are still around.
Yeah.
They're still alive. And I took it upon myself to reach out. Now, mind you, this was before the internet, so there was nothing to just tap into a search engine and try to find somebody or friend them on Facebook. So I
yeah.
had to look up brochures, telephone books, and eventually I tracked down a few people. And through mere coincidence, one person directly reached out to me because she was seeking internships for a media company that she was running. And that turns out to be Iris Morales, who to this day is my mentor. She's my godmother. She's been mentoring me for more than half my life now. And when she called me out of the blue, yes, I heard you were looking for internships. A good friend of mine told me I should reach out to you. I was like, oh my gosh, I know who you are. And she was like, kind of like taken aback. I was like, no. I mean, like, you've done so much work for our community. And that allowed me the opportunity to kind of like connect the dots in terms of like connection to my history. And oftentimes what happens to a people that are engaging in social justice work is that inevitable disconnect from one generation to the next. And what I wanted to do was maintain a connection. And what I'm doing with my storytelling is maintaining a connection visually. There's a lot of references to a lot of like historical moments engaging in dissent and social justice work. And I felt it was necessary artistically to interpret that in a medium that could be universally accepted and universally presented.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm doing with comic books, interestingly enough. But it was that kind of spark that started as a young person that has stayed with me ever since. And I just can't stand idly by and see any form of injustice without having to speak out against it. And I'm using the arts right now as an opportunity to kind of connect me on a local, if not global level, with what's happening with the world. And an opportunity, even like when I have these interviews, I don't sit in front of a microphone or in front of a camera and just talk about, you know, colors or artistic references or panel structures or...
Yeah, I've watched most of your interviews and I haven't heard you speak.
Yeah, I don't get into that because I just feel there's something much more important to talk about.
Yeah.
I did a keynote address at a youth conference a few weeks ago. This youth organization is actually 56 years old, called Aspira of New York. And it's actually a national organization now. And they invited me to be a keynote speaker. They actually also purchased 400 copies of my comic book, which they distributed for free to all the children that attended the event. And I'm watching the plenary session that's actually happening before my speech is supposed to be delivered. And I can see and feel the tone in the room that these young people were very concerned about our nation and where we're going and what we do next. And so I went up, and instead of delivering a speech about making comic books and how cool that is, I went up immediately and demanded a call to action from them. And I did a check in the room, and I asked, how many of you are going to be 18 this year? How many of you are going to be 18 next year? Well, guess what? You're going to be voting for the first time in this nation. You're actually going to be given the power to make a difference. And I know you're concerned about where we're going right now, but in just 2 years, you can actually be engaging in midterm elections. And it was just kind of like, what's that? What's midterm elections? Yeah. So I was like, great. So it was an opportunity to engage in kind of like a citizen's responsibility as an American in this country. And also to kind of like affirm their concerns and kind of like respond to it, as opposed to keeping the message very centered on my work.
Yeah.
I think my work is what it is, and I'm very proud of it, and I'm not taking away anything from that, but I'm especially proud of the artists that I was able to pull together for this project, because that in and of itself, I strongly feel, is an act of revolution and an act of resistance, because in an industry that is predominantly controlled and populated by white men, I saw an opportunity to bring as many people of color, and I did. I hired an all Puerto Rican roster of talent, and I even mentored a young woman for her first opportunity to be a published artist with this project. But when I have the forum to actually speak, I try to keep my work and my art as relevant to the world that we're living in right now. And I honestly thought before the book came out that it really wouldn't have a sustainability to it, because it's like, well, you know, it's a book, it'll come out, it'll buzz for a couple of weeks, and then it's done.
Yeah.
But what happened after this inauguration and the direction that this administration has taken, my book has become a different symbol for people. The Women's March reached out to me and they learned about my book and they asked if I could actually provide them with imagery of my character so that they could actually include it in their propaganda, you know? And I was like, my goodness, of course.
Yeah.
I really created this character for that. I created her because I saw that there was a void, and I wanted to create a character that spoke to a community that was underrepresented, and I didn't expect the response to be as powerful as it did.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that we always have to recognize about the superhero genre, especially where it is today, is that many of these characters that we enjoy, we go to the theater to watch the films, or we'll get the video games, or we'll buy the toys, or wear the t-shirts. At the end of the day, they're all corporate brands. And what I wanted to do with La Borinqueña was to create a brand that really resonated to the people. Something that really didn't have a corporate foundation
agenda
to it. But something, nothing that was kind of like contrived.
It's not about selling the most dolls. It's about reality. Right?
And then that image became something more than I expected it. And to hear and read women online responding so positively, and even men who come up to me after reading the book and they'll say, I see myself in her. This is amazing. I finally see a story that looks like my family, that sounds like me. And the joke is always when many of these women, they actually think that she actually is somebody real.
Yeah.
But then I actually try to get a little grounded with when I hear that. And I will actually engage in a longer conversation with these individuals. And I'll tell them, well, it does something to your psyche. When you grow up and you're watching imagery, and you're consuming this mass media imagery, and you just never see yourself. And you just end up doing things to yourself that you're not well aware of. You're changing the color of your hair. You're changing the color of your eyes. And when you finally see someone who looks exactly like you, who is unapologetically ethnic like you, you actually think she's somebody real.
Yeah.
And, you know, the response I always give people is that you're right. She is you. And she's you. And she's you. And she's you. Because for so long, when you don't see yourself, it just does something to your psychology. It just does something to your identity.
Do you remember noticing that as a kid? Like do you remember one of the first times even?
Well, I remember whenever I saw a person of color on screen, I would be excited. Especially it's about someone who was of Puerto Rican heritage, because we just weren't there. And I think as a young person, you tend to, I won't say, you adjust. That's what you do. You adjust. So oftentimes you just start adjusting to people with darker hair. Maybe Billy Joel's Puerto Rican. He's got really dark hair, you know? Yeah. But whenever there was a few moments where you would see someone, like, I remember how excited I was seeing Freddie Prinze with his own sitcom, Chico and the Man, you know, and it was just amazing to see a Puerto Rican comedian who was a star of his own television show. But it's tough growing up when you just don't see that. And, you know, you start listening and then you start loving different cultures that doesn't represent you. But then when you find, at least as I have, a sense of kind of like identity, I started listening to salsa music. And my Spanish wasn't even that good when I was growing up. But as an adult, I started listening to salsa music because it was a genre of music that was speaking to my identity.
Yeah.
You know? Now, I still listen to a little bit of everything else, but it's definitely something empowering when you start hearing people proudly exclaiming their heritage, even as recent as Bruno Mars did when he said, I didn't change my name because I was hiding from my heritage. I'm very proud to be the son of Pedro Hernandez. You know, I'm very proud of my Puerto Rican heritage. Now people are like, what is Puerto Rican? You know?
I didn't know it's Puerto Rican actually.
So therein lies kind of like this reality that oftentimes when we don't see ourselves, we lose ourselves. And I think growing up, I didn't see myself. And it wasn't until I was older that I just got tired of complaining.
Yeah.
You know? And I really did. And it was like, you know, I'm in a position right now where I have I don't have bountiful resources, but I just had enough to make an investment in my idea. And that's what I did. And I created this project with the hopes that it would resonate well. And, you know, I've been met with some good success. I'm very happy with the response that I'm receiving. Happy to say that it's actually helping me feel confident in working on the second book, which I'm very excited to start. And the other thing that I'm well aware of is that what this project is doing is that it's approaching publishing and it's approaching storytelling and it's approaching content in its distribution in a completely different way. It's going straight to the people. I'm not distributing my book through stores. I'm distributing my book directly to the people. So cultural institutions are inviting me. I'm looking to go to New Orleans, Puerto Rico, Chicago, Philadelphia.
And that's changed because of the internet.
It's changed so much because of the internet. Yeah. Because also people are so surprised at how accessible I actually am. Yeah. You know, they're like, they'll write me on Facebook Or they'll write the page on Facebook and I respond. They're like,
you're one of the most responsive people I know, actually.
Well, yeah, because I'm like, I have my phone on me all the time. Yeah, and if it's something whack, I'm not going to respond to you because I don't respond to trolls. I'll be real. Yeah. Like, you hating on me, I'm like, you can spread that hate someplace else. I don't have time for that. I don't have time for debate.
It actually brings up a good point because I think a lot of people listening to this is applicable to any business, organization, whatever you're working on. This direct to consumer, I guess, if you want to call it that, is a big trend over the last 10 years or so. And specifically in the last 5 years, if you look at like Casper Mattress and Warby Parker, that sort of brand, even though it's a completely different world to what you're doing, there's definitely parallels there. So I'm curious to hear, first of all, I did kind of want to go into the comic book space a little bit more because, to be honest, I didn't grow up reading comic books. I was never fully into it, but I did watch like movies and that sort of stuff. It just, there was never any like cousins or anyone that brought me them or, you know, I just never resonated.
What was interesting about my book is that I've been receiving an overwhelming response from women who are telling me they've never read comic books before.
Yeah, and
they're picking up a comic book for the very first time.
Yeah.
And I just hate to disappoint them to let them know that the rest of the industry doesn't look like this.
Yeah, yeah. But what I was thinking is, for people that don't know, like me or anyone who's listening, who are the people that are generally buying comic books? And, you know, because there's a whole thing here called Comic-Con, right? And I didn't know what it was until I moved to New York. But could you just describe from your experience what that industry looks like? I mean, it's not just kids, basically.
Well, no, geez.
Definitely not.
It actually, honestly, can start as young as children younger than my son. My son is 13. He's been reading comic books since he was easily like 7.
Yeah.
You know, and then it goes as high as probably like 87.
Yeah.
You know, because you have adults that have been reading comic books as far back as comic books have been created.
Yeah.
I mean, comic books have been out now, at least American comic books like Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, we're talking like 50 to 70 years that they've been out now. So you have people that have been loyally reading these books for years. And when you go to these events, Comic-Cons, and there's literally a Comic-Con happening every week in the United States.
What is Comic-Con for people that don't know what it is?
Well, Comic-Con, I mean, if you don't know what Comic-Con is by now, you're literally living under a rock. You know, you probably still have AOL CDs to give you free internet at this point. You know, it's actually, I like to describe Comic-Con as a safe space for nerds.
Yeah.
It's not even like a convention in the sense that there's going to be a forum to present new products. Of course, there's that. But what it fundamentally is a safe space for people who think differently to be in a company of themselves.
Safe space.
Yeah, it's like the one space. Like, I mean, if you want to wear an amazing costume or if you just want to have an opportunity to pontificate or have a conversation with someone about whether Hulk or Thor is stronger, it's an amazing physical space. I mean, people do it online, but to physically be in that space for two to four days.
There's a space where people come and there's talks and there's events.
And you'll see people literally hanging out all day and night, you know, and because it's something that they look forward to. And, you know, because for many years before the comic book industry became mainstream, it was always an underground culture.
Mm.
And individuals such as myself, we had our comic books that we'd buy every Wednesday. And as a result, we were kind of like, you know, ostracized because like, oh, you're reading all that nerdy stuff. But now everybody loves comic books, which is ridiculous. And people associate comic books only with movies. Mm. But reality is like comic books are still actual books. And what's amazing about what's happening with the comic book industry is that it's actually recognizing a surge in sales. People for some time were thinking that, oh, print is going to die. Perhaps comic books will have to become digital. How will they actually make their profit if they're actually selling digitally? Because when you sell comic books digitally, you're selling it at a fraction of what you would actually sell it print-wise. However, comic books are actually increasing
in sales. They're like a
collectible,
though, for me. That's how they feel.
And they're increasing in sales. And in terms of demographically what it looks like, it's a true cross-section of America. Young women, young men, men of color, young women of color, older men. Older women. It's such an incredible mix.
Mm.
Now, the mistake is when the industry doesn't reflect that in terms of like its content.
Yeah, because they
and
still
so what I'm doing with my storytelling is just like you're saying that how other vendors are doing in terms of business. I'm literally creating content that's going direct to the consumers. There is no need for me to do these national comic cons, and I actually haven't been doing these national comic cons. I've done one comic con for La Borinqueña, and that was actually in Puerto Rico. And I was received like I was Stan Lee, which is incredible for me. You know, it's phenomenally incredible. People wanted my autograph. People wanted to be photographed with me. And I think that working on two different projects, like working on Daryl Makes Comics with DMC and then working on Lo Borinqueña, they're completely different approaches in terms of how the products are sold and how the products reach their audiences. With DMC, he's an icon. So he's also a draw for these events. When we do Comic Cons, people want to meet this legendary icon. Yeah, they will bring their Adidas sneakers. They will bring their record albums because they want him to sign their memorabilia.
Yeah.
And then they'll pick up his comic book. They're not always necessarily picking up his comic book because it's an amazing book. And trust me, I work incredibly hard to produce a great book. But I'll be honest, the majority of the sales are from people that just love DMC.
DMC.
He's just an amazing icon. He's an amazing person also. Yeah. And we do the traditional route. We do events, Comic Cons, nationally, internationally.
Yeah.
Where La Borinqueña is a completely different spin. I'm finding much more of a positive response directly reaching the consumers. So I don't have to spell out the character's name phonetically. I don't have to constantly translate the character, her origin, or her why her father is dark complexion and her mother is white complexion.
It.
It's just a natural identity.
Yeah.
And when people see that, they recognize that. So those two books have completely different audiences. There's a little overlap, but not enough to kind of like sustain the two kind of like together.
Yeah.
So they literally exist in different universes real way.
So you brought up DMC and how you're working with him. So how did that come about and what's it been like working with him? Because I know I've seen in some of your other interviews you mentioned, you know, you were a fan of Run DMC.
I've always been a fan of Run DMC.
Before you met him.
Yeah.
So how did
I used to wear Adidas. I used to wear Run DMC Adidas brand clothing when I was in high school. I was introduced to DMC via my friend Rigo Morales, who is actually the senior vice president of A&R at Atlantic Records.
Mm.
And that conversation turned into the genesis of starting our own publishing company because he's just so fascinated with comic books.
He's been into comic books since he was a kid, I remember.
Always has been. Yeah. And he just saw this as an opportunity to get into something that he was always passionate about as a child. So I came up with the idea of creating a universe around his character. And I came up with the idea of making him into a superhero.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, the people initially thought about the idea of a DMC comic book, they thought it was going to be biographical.
Of the music or the era or whatever.
And what I did was, I actually do cultivate the stories to be quasi-biographical, but it's rooted in a superhuman universe.
Yeah.
So he's literally the first superhero in that universe, and we're creating all these other characters. And he's having the most fun time of his life.
Yeah.
Like, literally, we're sitting in rooms and just kind of like coming up with these new stories, and we'll bring a professional writer to come in to develop these stories into scripts.
So how do you guys work together? Like, what's his role versus
your role? Well, he's a publisher.
He's a publisher.
He completely funds and produces the capital needed to make the books.
Yeah.
As editor-in-chief, I actually hire the staff and I oversee the production of the actual books. And then we collaboratively come together to develop stories.
Yeah.
We present these ideas to each other. We debate these ideas to each other. And once we feel confident with the story idea, we'll present it to a writer that I'll hire.
Mm.
In this case, we've been working with writer Amy Chu for the last two books. And it's an opportunity to kind of like work with professionals in the industries. So it's a great experience. It truly is. And then when we're on the road, it's also an amazing experience. The way fans respond to him is beautiful.
He's hilarious too. I mean,
he is. But he's also authentic. He's very sincere. He's very grounded. And I've learned a lot working with him. And I've also learned about a lot about the industry working with him. And I've applied a lot of that to what I'm doing with my own projects. And I think I was having a conversation with my wife about that I've been working for myself for these 17 years and working for other clients. And it wasn't until working on La Borinqueña that I realized that all of the experience that I've acquired has actually helped me achieve the level of success that I have been able to do with this project. And I didn't sit down and come up with a business plan, and I didn't sit down and come up with a marketing strategy, and I didn't sit down and hire a team of professionals to direct the publicity or the advertising.
Yeah.
The only professionals,
all
it's all been me. The only professionals I brought into this project were the artists.
Yeah.
And I was the actual, like, the most inexperienced artist working on this project in terms of the comic book industry. I brought in 17 years of experience as an art director, but I've never actually was working 17 years as a publisher or as a writer, for that matter. And, you know, I took a chance. you know, a chance that was recognized by the mayor of the city of New York for giving me a proclamation, a chance that's like sold out in the first run of my book. So now I'm looking at a second printing with an artist respected in the industry for decades, George Perez, who's actually going to be doing another cover. In the industry, you refer to them as variant covers. He's actually doing a cover for the second printing of the book. Mm. And he's Puerto Rican. And people celebrate him, nothing to do with his heritage.
Yeah.
It just happens to be he's literally our generation's like Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
He's that phenomenally recognized for his work. And when he learned about my work, we personally had a conversation about it. He offered to do the cover for me. And it was I could not turn that down.
Yeah.
And we shared a trip together in Puerto Rico. And I brought him to his very first Comic-Con. He never stepped foot in Puerto Rico. And it was because of my work as an activist and as an organizer that I'm able to do these things. Because like, I approach the work that I do with the idea of community building, with the idea of movement building. And I did it with my book, and I continue to do it with my message. And my message is one that our heritage and our culture is actually our true superpower.
Yeah.
And when we embrace that, we actually find ourselves in a stronger position to withstand and resist so much more. And we just can't walk away from it. We have to embrace our heritage and culture. And that's what actually makes us all an amazing nation as citizens of the United States, when we embrace our diversity.
So just switching gears a bit, I've noticed that with your latest project, you've been able to get a crazy amount of press. And, you know, you've been featured in New York Times, Washington Post, been on Hot 97, a bunch of TV channels, CNN. And there's two parts of that, because again, I want the people listening to be able to take away some lessons from what you've done. It sounds like it maybe wasn't a huge big plan to get on CNN, but there were some things that happened organically. At the same time, I do see you use social media pretty well, even just as a personal friend on there. So if we could just break that down into two, one was the press side and one is how you've been able to put the word out there with social media.
Well, a few years ago, I became very savvy with social media. I would say maybe like in the last 2 years, I became very aware of the power of social media. And I also saw that as a professional who works for himself, that my most successful approach to acquiring more opportunities professionally for myself would be by making myself into a brand.
Mm.
I had a friend, a very successful entrepreneur, who would occasionally jab at my post that I would do years ago.
Yeah.
And he would just hit me off on the side. And he was like, nobody wants to know that you did that. Nobody wants to know that you did that. And at first I thought, man, he's just being a jerk. And I was like, no, there's actually some insight to what he's saying. You know, there's some more substance. And what he was trying to say in so many words was, people want to know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
People want to know why you create. People don't want to know what you create. They want to know why you create.
Yeah.
And I got hip to that very quick. So I realized, okay, I'm a dad. I'm married. I create art that oftentimes resonates well with some people, especially my clients. And I'm able to get the work that I get because of referrals. I don't actually solicit myself professionally. I don't go to forums. I don't go to conventions. I don't go to, you know, any entrepreneurial sessions that are held that are inviting, you know, people to solicit themselves. I get my work through referrals. So about 2 years ago, I realized that my brand had to be me. So I had to refine who I was.
Mm.
And it didn't take that much, you know, definition, because I pretty much was just a simple dude. You know, I'm a homebody. I love being with my wife and my sons, engaging with my friends, going to art shows. So I realized that was going to actually be my brand.
Mm.
And when I had the idea of developing La Borinqueña, I realized that my narrative was just as important as this character and this project.
Mm.
So I really had to hone in on who I was and what my message was. And that's this message of this young man who grew up in the South Bronx, and it has evolved into this, you know, family man who lives now in Brooklyn, fundamentally a New Yorker story or an American story. And that in turn helped me focus on what my message needed to be. And using social media in the way that I do, my goal isn't to have 40 million or 40,000 followers.
Yeah.
I'm very specific who I get my message out to and who I follow and who follows me. I have tastemakers that follow me. I have journalists and writers, other people who create content who follow me.
That's a good
point.
So
because I have, and you go to my Twitter account, it's just about 2,000 people following me. It's not, but it's who I choose to follow and who chooses to follow me that is why the my narrative is so, I guess, so accessible and why I'm so accessible and why my story became much more than just a comic book writer, but it became kind of like an artist who had his finger on the pulse of what needed to be said at that very moment. And the mere fact that I'm bilingual, fully bilingual, helps me a lot. No individual can kind of like navigate so many different like realms of media successfully. I mean, particularly given that mainstream media just kind of like wants to just put you in a box. And especially if you're a person of color who's bilingual. So one of the things I recognize very quickly is the power of Latino media. Latino media is so strong that it literally has its own brands, multiple brands in Spanish, internationally and nationally across the United States. And once I recognized that, I realized that if I can fine-tune my message, I can reach an international audience and a national audience. And that was the different approach that I had to my work. I didn't focus strictly on getting local news or just news across the United States. I focused on making a message that would resonate internationally. And my story's been picked up by news outlets in England, in Spain, in Italy, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, and across the United States.
So would you say it's accurate to say you focused the most of your effort on getting the why right and making sure the message that you're actually spreading is authentic and real, and that's where you've put your energy? It's not necessarily about reaching out to journalists.
It's not contrived. This is who I am. I didn't have to like edit anything out or add or embellish anything. This is just fundamentally who I am. And what ends up happening when I do a story, when I'm interviewed for a story, is as often as the case, those people who have interviewed me become my friends. And they stay following me, you know. And anytime I have a new idea for something, they want to hear what my new idea is. And I realized quickly that that's what a publicist is. A publicist is an individual that has amazing relationships with journalists.
So you're your own publicist.
I'm my own publicist. So I'm able to kind of like navigate and create my own content. I'm able to navigate and create my own narrative and control my narrative. And I also know who I am. So I know when to kind of like steer a conversation in one direction or another direction, because I know what's relevant to talk about from my life experience and what isn't.
So just quick question on the journalist. You mentioned tastemakers and people that are following you. Like, did they all reach out to you? Were there ever times where you've proactively tried to reach out to press yourself?
I do reach out when necessary. I mean,
like through Twitter, or like how do you do that?
I reach out oftentimes. I do a lot of reading. If I see an amazing piece, I follow that writer.
Okay.
And when the time is right, oftentimes maybe I'll reach out to him or her. You know,
but just through email or Twitter, like more
through specific, social media.
Through social media,
I reach out to people through social media, and you know, and if I get a response, it's mostly because they'll read up on me. Because I mean, like everybody, it's like even if you're on the phone with somebody, and the whole time you're having a conversation with that person for the first time, you're literally checking them out online. And how do you spell your first name again? You know, and I'm aware of that. So if I reach out to someone, I know that they're gonna check out my
your
work and check out what I'm about. And if they and I'm also aware that when you literally look up my name, when you Google me, you literally will find a few pages of all the mainstream media coverage I've gotten. And that just legitimizes me. You know, and
once
I think
you've got one, it helps.
You're able and to I think as an independent creator, that's so important to be able to have like mainstream media kind of coverage. Now, I can't provide any advice. It's just something that very much works for me.
Sounds like you've organically, but you've had like a long-term relationship mindset. It's not like, oh, I need to get this in here so I can send the CNN link to NBC.
And also what happens for me, I'm very fortunate. People will reach out to me who are acquainted with other agencies. So this piece may have been come from BuzzFeed, but then that person at BuzzFeed knows somebody at Huffington Post. It's like, I got to tell you, I got to my homegirl about you because she needs to do a piece about you, you know, and so it's a lot of interconnectedness that happens behind the scenes. And, you know, oftentimes these pieces, when they come out, they're kind of like gateways to other opportunities. I do an interview with NBC. All of a sudden, the next day, I'm getting interviewed by Telemundo. I'm being interviewed by Impacto News, or I'm being interviewed by La Información from Spain, or I'm being interviewed by Elle magazine in Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an Italian interview. It was crazy. So and it's like, and then one piece leads to another. And then, you know, with social media, it's so easy to just like follow somebody. And if it's a legitimate inquiry, you know, I follow up on it. And if it's something, you know, solid, then, you know, it'll turn into a very valid opportunity for me.
Cool. We're going to wrap up soon. We're going to have to make a move. But, man, I really appreciate you coming
on,
really enjoyed it. It feels like we could speak here for 3 hours. So we'll have to save that for part two. But the last question I do have for you is, do you have an ask for the people listening? And especially, you know, we talked a lot about activism and what's going on. But it's a very interesting time for everyone, no matter what side of the spectrum you're on. So is there an ask you have for people listening to this?
I think fundamentally what our nation needs is to embrace itself. And I think oftentimes when we live in a homogenous world, in a homogenous community, we don't expand our views and opinions. And I think the most important thing that we need to do as a nation is to engage in conversations with those of us who may not always see eye to eye with us. I'm not gonna get caught up into this, we need healing, but we definitely need more dialogue. And then in addition to that, we need to be resilient, you know, like Nelson Mandela was, you know, and if we need to, we need to march, and if we need to, we need to boycott. And I think, but most importantly, what we need to do is listen. And I think when you listen, you understand, and when you understand, you become sympathetic. And when you become sympathetic, then you begin to heal, you know. And as a result of that, we can actually have some sort of significant growth and change in our nation. So I guess my ask is just to listen to one another. And if need be, try to go a little out of your way to listen to others, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great way to finish off, man. I appreciate all your stories.
Doubt.
And I'm glad we got this on the record, man. We'll be having many more of these conversations. So hopefully we'll have you back on the show as well.
Thank you for having me, bro.
Cheers, man.
Peace.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.